From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The arc of the moral universe is long, said Martin Luther King, but it bends toward justice. We'd like to think so. But how does it do that exactly in a democracy? For Abraham Lincoln, as for King, that was not a theoretical question. For Lincoln, it came in war, in high moral goals, and compromise, and pragmatism. Lincoln is huge again right now in the movies, in the White House. This hour on Point, we go deep on Lincoln, to deep Lincoln, on democracy, on morality, and where we're headed. You can join the conversation. What big lessons do you draw from Abe Lincoln? What would Lincoln do, say, on our challenges today, political and moral? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Let's have a little drum roll here first, just because Lincoln is so big in popular culture right now. Here's a bit from the trailer of Steven Spielberg's film, Lincoln.
Shall we stop this bleeding? Abolishing slavery settles the fate for millions now in bondage and unborn millions to come.
It's either the amendment or this Confederate peace. You cannot have both.
No one's loved as much as you by the people. Don't waste that power.
How many hundreds of thousands have died during your administration?
We must cure ourselves of slavery. This amendment is that cure. The fate of human dignity is in our hands. Blood's been spilled to afford us this moment. Now, now, now.
And there, the Hollywood treatment for Abraham Lincoln. It's big. It'll be big at the Oscars this weekend. We've got a great, big, and important book in front of us with some big, deep thinking. Joining me in the studio is John Burt, professor of English at Brandeis University, author of the acclaimed, big, new book, Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism, Lincoln, Douglas, and Moral Conflict. The New York Times calls it a work every serious student of Lincoln will have to read. John Burt, welcome. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you very much.
You must have timpani drums for yourself every time you walk into class at Brandeis, right?
Well, I'm actually on sabbatical right now, I haven't had that experience.
Gosh, this is a wonderful kind of counterpoint of depth to all the popular appreciation, adulation of Lincoln right now. I welcome it all. But this really is terrific, and I look forward to digging in with you this hour. It's a big book. It's deep. It's a work of years. You've got philosophy in here. You've got analysis of Lincoln's rhetoric and tying it back to that philosophy. You look a lot in particular at Lincoln and Douglas, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and what was shown there. But way into it here, you write that Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, provides a model, you say, for moral agency in a complex world in which one must make one's way among various half-understood alternatives, none of which leaves one's hands very clean. Boy, does that sound contemporary. The biggest context you put him in, maybe you tell us, is democracy itself and the challenge that democracy brings, confronts, morality with. Take us to that point.
Well, I think the key about the relationship of democracy and morality is my conscience commands me, but it has to persuade you.
I think I know what's right. I'm determined to do it, but I can't be a dictator in a democracy.
And indeed, if I don't persuade you and compel you, then I'm not behaving in a democratic way either.
We're not in a democracy at a certain point if you do that.
It may be a high-minded tyranny, but it's still a tyranny. I have an obligation to persuade you. I have an obligation to get you to accept defeat on things that may matter to you highly.
Gosh, this sounds contemporary.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I have an obligation also to see you as somebody who is capable of the same kind of agency I have.
Moral agency or merely the wielding of power?
Well, moral agency.
Mm-hmm. Even if I'm a Southern slave owner.
Well, Lincoln worked very hard to imagine a Southern slaveholder with whom he could morally deal. He turned out to be mistaken about where the slaveholders were. But his imagined Southern slaveholder was somebody like Jefferson or somebody like Henry Clay, who lived with slavery because it was given to him, didn't like it, wanted to end it, didn't see how. And to those people, he offered an olive branch. Mm-hmm. I won't end it suddenly.
I have empathy. I see where you stand.
I will, if I do end it, I will do it with your consent and with compensation.
Trusting that you are going to come on this moral arc with me.
And I will limit where it goes to compromise its economic vitality. I won't let it go into the Western territories.
Mm-hmm.
He expected some pushback even from that kind of slaveholder.
That morally aware slaveholder who was uncomfortable with this institution.
Exactly.
Slavery.
Mm-hmm. And even he was aware that slaveholder opinion was hardening, that things like the invention of the cotton gin mm-hmm. had changed the calculus about slavery.
Made it more profitable.
And also after 1832, there's an increasing tendency among slaveholders to argue that it's a good thing, not merely a bad thing they don't know how to get rid of.
Good because it undergirds a way of life that they value in the South.
Well, also because in their view, it undergirded the ability of white people to have democracy with each other.
Ah.
As long as they did mm-hmm. not have slavery, white people would have to oppress each other.
That's the model they knew.
That's the model they knew.
Mm-hmm.
Their ability to treat each other as equals, they felt, was completely built on their ability to get somebody else to do all the heavy lifting. Their understanding is that our understanding and Lincoln's understanding is that there is a tension between slaveholding and democracy.
Yes.
But Southerners felt it was the precondition of democracy.
Though they saw in the North that there wasn't slavery and yet there was democracy.
Well, they thought that the North had slavery too. They just called it capitalism.
Uh-huh. It was just whites or whoever under that heel.
And if they made the property argument about slavery, slaves are property like any other, that mm-hmm. sounds like a very trumping kind of argument. It's at least a foreclosing way of making an argument.
Though a morally puncturable argument.
Right. Lincoln approached that argument in a very interesting way. He said, I know you say that because it sounds convincing, mm-hmm. but I doubt whether you really believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say in a famous speech he gave in Peoria in 1854, if you really believe that, why is it that you look down on slave dealers?
Mm-hmm.
You don't look down on horse dealers. Slaves are obviously not the same thing as horses.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you allow your children to play with your slaves' children, but you don't allow them to play with the slave dealer's children?
Why do you not volunteer to be a slave yourself?
Yes. He said, if slavery is a positive good, it's a positive good nobody seemed to choose for himself.
But you say he miscalculated or miscomprehended.
Well,
misapprehended that moral slave owner ideal that he had in mind. And that puts us on the path to war.
Exactly. He kept expecting that he was going to find slaveholders of the Henry Clay variety
mm-hmm.
because he had had friends who were that kind of mm-hmm. slaveholder. Joshua mm-hmm. Speed, his best friend as a young man, was mm-hmm. that kind of slaveholder.
Mm-hmm.
His wife's family were that kind of slaveholders. Mm-hmm. I think that he was taken aback by the intensity of the commitment of Southerners to a positive good ideology of slavery. And I think he underestimated the power of loyalty politics in the South.
Mm-hmm.
There was a ferocious issue in Southern politics of who was going to be trustworthy to the South, who was going to be loyal to the South, who is a traitor to the South.
Again, echoes in our party politics
exactly.
today.
And that forced Southern politicians into a race to the bottom to utterly irrational positions.
And battle formation.
Exactly. I mean, the really last straw happened in 1857-58 over the question of whether Kansas was going to be a free territory or a slave
mm-hmm.
territory.
Free soil.
Now, Stephen Douglas had, at enormous sacrifice to himself, and it may be the worst mistake ever made by an intelligent American politician, had mm-hmm. opened Kansas territory to slavery. And he had set loose a foot race for control of the territory, which resulted in really 6 years of civil war there.
Mm-hmm.
But by 1858, it was clear that the Free Soilers had won in Kansas. By better than 10-1, Kansas rejected slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Douglas had always felt that if you had showed the South that they'd had their run, they would accept their defeat. But that didn't turn out to be true.
And he was supposed to be the wheeler dealer, the practical one here.
Exactly. And the thing that really shocked Douglas is that the South would not accept a fair defeat on terms they themselves had specified.
There were absolutes at work here in the minds of the South and in the mind of Abraham Lincoln.
And in the mind of Lincoln. There are Abraham's absolute commitments, yes.
And the challenge here, then as now, how to deal with absolutes and absolute commitments in a democracy that requires dealing to make progress. And with that, you write in the new book, even the sort of fate of democracy itself, like whether it can deliver those good outcomes or those ideals that are imagined. John Burt, there's so much more we're going to dive into here. It's great to have you here. The big new book is Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism, Lincoln, Douglas, and Moral Conflict. Here's Ry Cooder with a song from way back there, Rally Around the Flag. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Abraham Lincoln, morality and democracy, then and now, how to strive for the good in a system that can reward the bad, that can stymie the good, and lots of people get to define what that is, or try to. John Burt is with us from Brandeis University. His big new book is Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism, Lincoln, Douglas, and Moral Conflict. To read an excerpt, and it's really something, go to our website, onpointradio.org. It was not quite as simple in history, in reality, as in this moment from Spielberg's film Lincoln, where Abraham Lincoln is laying it all down as high concept math.
Euclid's first common notion is this: things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. That's a rule of mathematical reasoning. It's true because it works, has done, and always will do. In his book, Euclid says this is self-evident.
Self-evident, a bit of an important phrase right there. I want to come to the Lincoln-Douglas debates, but first, and this will bring us back to this point, but unwind this phrase, Lincoln's tragic pragmatism. It's your title. It can sound as though you're saying, oh, he's a tragically flawed human being. But I think you're meaning something else here.
Yes.
That he was aiming for a high moral goal, and found that tragically he had to pursue it in quite pragmatic ways. Well, maybe that's just democracy again. But unfold that phrase for us.
Well, I mean by the phrase not to criticize pragmatism as a tragic error. I mean by the phrase to argue that moral situations are so entangled and so complicated and so full of double binds, mm-hmm. that deep conflicts don't lend themselves to clean hand solutions.
Mm-hmm. Because interests are so embedded, minds are so ingrained.
And because things that we value deeply are contradictory with each other. Things that we have no reason to assume that our deepest values all sort with each other.
Jeez, bummer. Yes.
I mean, we believe that it's trumping to argue that there's a contradiction, but I think it's human that our values contradict each other. They do all the time.
So in 1859, what would that have put front and center?
Well, the chief thing that Lincoln and Douglas are fighting over is the relationship between principle and consent in a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
There are extreme positions you could take either way. The right is anything the majority happens to want. And that's a view that's often attributed to Douglas, though mm-hmm. I don't think that's what his view was.
Could sound that way.
Yeah. Or you could say on the other side, let God's will be done though the heavens fall, which usually does make the heavens fall and doesn't make God's will be done.
Meaning we're going to go for the moral, for the right, and damn the consequences.
Yeah. Now, neither Lincoln nor Douglas felt that way, but they did approach the same point from opposite sides. One of the most fascinating moments in the Steven Spielberg film mm-hmm. is the way Lincoln replays the arguments of the Lincoln-Douglas debates on both sides during the film. He replays the arguments of the Lincoln-Douglas debates with Francis Preston Blair, mm-hmm. with himself as Lincoln and Blair as Douglas. But when he's arguing with Thaddeus Stevens, he replays all the same issues
mm-hmm.
with Stevens as Lincoln and himself as Douglas.
Give us the debate then. If we were there, what would we have heard that points to these two men's different views and what they say about their assessment of democracy and their assessment of the best or way out of this problem?
Well, the contradiction is, if you have reached an impasse where you don't really have a compelling value you can use against the other side, then you're faced with a tragic choice. Usually in persuasion, the way persuasion works is you make a compelling appeal to a shared value.
Meaning ultimately a successful appeal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A successful appeal to
could
a value
be compelling
your
but unsuccessful,
has.
But
yeah, right.
Ultimately successful. Mm-hmm.
That you have to persuade your opponent that you understand not just what values are, but you understand your opponent better than your opponent does.
Mm-hmm.
You offer an interpretation of your opponent's character, which is transformative, but also persuasive to
what
the opponent.
What was Douglas's effort then? What was Lincoln's?
Well, the difference between them is what they felt you had to do to make a compromise.
Okay.
There were certain lines Lincoln would never cross because there were certain things that he felt you had to buy into if you were going to be somebody with whom people could deal.
Most of all, going back to the Declaration of Independence.
Exactly. And Lincoln and Douglas have an enormous fight about the meaning of the Declaration. For Lincoln, those promises in the first few sentences of the Declaration are the
– all men created equal.
Without them – you can't deal because you don't know what is going to persuade somebody who doesn't believe that. You also don't know what somebody who doesn't believe that might be capable of doing to you. You're at sea with that kind of person. And Lincoln felt that the meaning of those words was under threat from Douglas and most of all from Calhoun.
Was Douglas willing to jettison the meaning of those words?
No. But Douglas,
but he was prepared to somehow accept slavery in spite of accepting those words?
Both Lincoln and Douglas were prepared to accept slavery if they had to. Neither Lincoln nor Douglas wanted slavery to go to the Western territories.
They were. Well, let's just pause there. If Lincoln really took those words seriously, all men created equal from the Declaration of Independence, how could he be prepared to accept slavery if he had to? What's that mean?
Well, he interpreted what Jefferson meant by those words. Lincoln and Douglas had the same fight about Jefferson's meaning of those words that scholars have nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln said he meant those words. He knew he was not in a position to make them come into effect, but he wanted to make sure that they would continue to make us unhappy until we got in a position to make them happen.
Ah. Okay. So there was a readiness to wait and work over time if necessary.
It was a promise he knew he couldn't fulfill but which he wished to register
mm-hmm.
so that we wouldn't forget about it and so that it would shape our consciousness and keep us on the lookout for ways to make it happen.
That's exactly
the kind of promise we have about Lincoln and racial equality.
Let us earmark that and come back to it because you described that as fundamental then to his idea of democracy, that there would be many moral goals which would not all be met at once and more goals would emerge and present themselves over time as we came to understand our own enterprise.
Exactly. I think the idea is that we understand the meaning of our values very obscurely when we commit ourselves to them. We know they commit us to things we're not ready to do, and there are other things that probably aren't even in our focal consciousness that are implied by those promises that come to focal consciousness when events force them to the surface of our minds.
So
like gender equality, for instance.
And on things we don't even quite fully perceive yet. When then did Lincoln – when did it tear for him? When did he say, wait – my image of that Southern slaveholder, my understanding of his mind is wrong, is mistaken. There's a disagreement here over the Declaration of Independence and equality that is so profound that it can't be. When did this happen?
I think it happened in stages, and I also think that Lincoln went back and forth on it. Certainly the House Divided speech looks to me like it's a drawing of a line.
Mm-hmm.
But the values of the first inaugural speech are very different from those of the House Divided speech. The first inaugural speech says, I'm willing to stand for a constitutional amendment that will make slavery last forever as long as you stay in the Union.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it took really a year or two of war to bring Lincoln completely around to say, we have to settle this issue now, and to decide that the war is going to be about emancipation and not just about reunion.
Now, you say that the fundamental Lincoln-Douglas debate was over principle versus consent in democracy. Consent, we can understand pretty easily. I mean, that is very pragmatic. Douglas saying we can only do what we can get consent to do from the constituent states. But Lincoln somehow brought principle in. How did he do that? Where was that rooted? How did he look at that?
Well, Douglas never fully understood what it meant to bring principle in, because for him, you mostly bring in principle as a pretext for bringing in artillery.
Yeah, principle was just a way of greasing the skids.
That it's a big stick to hit your opponent over the head with.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen our country use that here and there now and then.
And his whole idea of the whole job of a politician is to persuade people to put off killing each other for the next couple of weeks. And then after that, we'll have to do it over again on some other basis completely contradicting the basis we just did.
And so principle was fancy talk. It was instrumental. For Lincoln?
For Lincoln, he was hoping to awaken the conscience of people with whom he had had a tradition of dealing. That's what he meant by the better angels of our nature that he alluded to in the first inaugural address. Mm-hmm. What that means is that if you listen to the still small voice in the back of your mind, if you allow yourself to detach yourself from the immediate partisan advantage, which is what was going on in the South in those times, the secessionists were mounting a coup, really. It's not totally clear that the majority of the white population of much of the South favored secession, but they were outmaneuvered and outargued and really outrailed politics.
Echoes today, yes.
Lincoln was hoping to call people back to themselves. It's the same kind of appeal Martin Luther King would make. One of the reasons King was so successful is that he spoke the language of his opponents, and he was able to argue that if you think deeply, you'll realize that your best self is already aligned with me, and that if you allow yourself to listen to what you deeply believe, that will work through. That wasn't totally available to Lincoln.
But what made Lincoln believe or think that principle was embedded in democracy or had to be, this sort of ghost in the machine? I mean, it's not there. I mean, it is there in the Constitution, and yet there's also
a lot of
– exactly. It's more about power and how it will be shared. Here's Douglas making the argument, look, it's the good in a democracy is what we vote for. It's what – you know, it's the consent we reach. But where did Lincoln look to justify or to find that germ of principle beyond and above?
Well, I think it's a theory about reciprocity and acknowledgement, that I am only capable of freedom if I concede your freedom and see you as a moral equal, see you as somebody who has the same claim to respect, the same claim on the absolute, the same claim to the infinite value of having a soul.
But this sounds like John Rawls a century later. Where did Abraham Lincoln rail splitter get that?
Oh, I think that's what he thought he got from Jefferson. Mm-hmm. There's a transformation going on in our understanding of what a democracy is through the first half of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Really, before the American Revolution, a republic is an agreement among insiders from which outsiders are excluded.
It's a deal. You know,
the Athenian democracy, the Athenian polis, was only available to insiders, to citizens. Mm-hmm. Outsiders lived in a world of subjection and hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And they felt that subjection and hierarchy was what bought them that freedom. That's how Aristotle describes it.
But that was still there. You say before the American Revolution. That was in the American, if not revolution, Constitution, two-thirds and slavery?
And this is the kind of thing that people like James Henry Hammond, who defended slavery, said about it. It's the kind of thing John Calhoun said about it, that all free societies are founded on the subjection of other people.
So do you want one or not?
And only subjection buys you – only subjection of the outsider buys the insiders the freedom to deal with each other.
So where did Lincoln get the chutzpah to say, no, it's more?
Well, I think part of it comes from the Radical Reformation. The idea, though I don't think Lincoln would have said it came from that. I mean, he was attracted to it through Milton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think the idea that the human conscience is a little spark of the divine.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea that an authentic moral decision is something that you can only do freely. Mm-hmm. I think the idea that you only have the freedom you're willing to give to others. I mean, I think that those are ideas you could find in St. Paul. You don't have to find them in Rawls. You could certainly find them in Jesus. Lincoln always argued this is a world of compensations, using the rather harsh term that Emerson used, that meaning? If you don't give freedom, mm-hmm. you lose it.
And if you deny it, you'll be denied.
Yeah. And Lincoln presided over a transformation of the meaning of democracy as the natural birthright of all people as people. That really is something that's first occurring in Jefferson.
Did he rage against democracy's failure to support him in championing this principle?
I'm not sure I totally – I think he chafed against it.
He spoke. But you're writing in here about how democracy itself – I mean, I read you saying you're not so sure democracy ends up on that moral arc bending necessarily the way Martin Luther King said it would.
Well, there's I remember what Churchill said about mm-hmm. the United States. He said, the Americans will invariably do the right thing, but only after they have exhausted every alternative.
Yeah, well, damn, that was close in the Civil War, I have to say. That was a great exhaustion.
Lincoln's feeling about democracy is mixed. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I think he's aware that democracy is thoroughly complicit in slavery, might even be dependent on it. I think he's also aware that democracy has sharpened, not resolved, the conflicts over slavery. I mean, one of the reasons slavery ended most places in the New World without civil war. And it wasn't – and one of the reasons
– Except for Haiti, no place else went to war to end it
exactly.
in the New World except us.
Because in the United States, there was enough of a democracy that the slaveholders had a say – and could use the fact that they had a say mm-hmm. to forestall any accommodation that would weaken their position.
So morality be damned if that was your view.
But I also think that democracy made conflict over slavery impossible to avoid. Because slaveholders understood that slavery would always be under threat, mm-hmm. they never trusted the non-slaveholding states. They never trusted the non-slaveholding whites of the slave states, and they never trusted the marginally enslaved states of the Upper South, whom they always suspected – the Deep South always suspected that the Upper South would cut them loose mm-hmm. and would imagine some future in which they themselves wouldn't have slavery. Virginia almost abolished slavery in 1832. Kentucky fully expected that the future of slavery would not include it.
But they didn't have to do it, and so –
Well, this forced the slaveholders into, I think, a totally suicidal quest for mastery of the Republic, which made them ultimately demand things that the Republic could not give.
And there stood Abraham Lincoln. John Burt is with us. His new book is Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism, Lincoln, Douglas, and Moral Conflict. You can join us. How do you see Lincoln, the idealist, the moralist, the pragmatist, the leader? How might Lincoln look at our moral challenges today? Here's We Are Coming, Father Abraham, Chris Vallejo. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We are coming, Father Abram, 600,000 more. We are coming, coming, our union to restore. We are coming, Father Abram, 600,000 more.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Abraham Lincoln, morality, and democracy then and now. My guest is John Burt of Brandeis University. His big new book is Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. All kinds of response here. Boy, oh boy, online. Let's see. Christos says, Lincoln ran against chattel slavery and wage slavery. He would be an anti-capitalist class warrior now. Debbie says, most people equate Lincoln with ending slavery, but this had a lot more to do with ending states' rights. There's a perspective. I mean, you know it. It was certainly vivid then. Rebecca, quoting Lincoln, I think here, says, I'm a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts.
Yeah, he said that.
Abe Lincoln. Another listener says, you know, a notable – to that point, a notable feature of Lincoln's time and this discussion is the ability of a politician to make a reasoned argument and the ability of the electorate to follow a reasoned argument. In the age of television and video games, is our representative democracy in danger because of our inability to do either? And then, Scott, just one more, and we'll go to our caller. Scott says, the world is a mess. The world is perfect. The Civil War was a mess. That's likewise the current state of affairs. Rarely moral, not even for a single day. A fleet of drones and teen pilots wielding joysticks won't change that either. We'll look at that more. Zach in Hammond, Louisiana. Zach, thank you for calling. You're on the air with John Burt.
Hi, Tom. One of the points that I wanted to bring up was that you know, you can look at Dr. Freeling of the University of Kentucky, of his two-volume work on succession. Succession, the push for succession over slavery, is a very long-running idea in the South. And then you also have a book by Charles Dew, The Apostles of Disunion, which highlights how the Southern state secession commissioners whipped up into a frenzy all of the ideas used to push for succession.
And John Burt is nodding vigorously to both of those, Zach. What do you take from that? Where do you want to go with that?
And where I'm going with that is that by the time Lincoln is elected, Lincoln's goal, his main focus is not slavery. Lincoln's main focus was the preservation of the Union. Lincoln's entire focus is he came into the presidency of the United States of America. His main focus and the main focus of the early to mid-war effort was the preservation of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And until Lincoln realizes that the war cannot be won and the Union cannot be saved until slavery is dealt with, then does slavery become the central issue of the war. And you can see in Eric Foner's fantastic work on Lincoln and slavery specifically, that Lincoln's view on slavery evolved slowly over time, that Lincoln never was one of the ardent abolitionists, that the radicals, you know, in the Republican Party were very far ahead of Lincoln, you know, when it comes to slavery, and it slowly, as the war dragged on, Lincoln evolved it to this point. And
Zach, you have an instant and ardent fan in my guest, John Burt. You know your stuff. He's nodding vigorously here. Let me bring it to him, if I may, Zach. How about it, John Burt? Lincoln is high-minded, pushing for the moral high ground, or the practical sort of desperate push for union above all else until...
Well, I think I want to put in a plug for Freeling, who I think is really one of the great historians. That's just a wonderful book, and Foner's book on Reconstruction is also a superb book. And his book on Lincoln's evolution about race, I've forgotten the immediate title, it just came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
Superb book.
Thanks
superb
for all
books.
Those, Zach. And yes, good job.
I think Zach is right that Lincoln understood his task at the beginning of his presidency to be to restore the Union. And he also understood that to do that, he would have to put emancipation on the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
He understood, as he said in the letter he wrote to Albert Hodges after emancipation, that the oath he had taken as president did not allow him to emancipate slavery or to find a pretext to end slavery, to emancipate the slaves, or allow him to think up pretexts for doing it. I think that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in Lincoln's – at the same time, Lincoln did not give up on the issue on which he had been elected, which is the pledge to keep slavery out of the Western territories.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in Lincoln's mind over the first 2 years of the war is that circumstances changed to allow him a good way to strike a blow against slavery. Now, when General
opportunity
Hunter,
once
exactly
again. Okay.
When General Hunter or General Fremont tried to emancipate slaves in their districts, Lincoln rebuked them and took those proclamations back, fearing that they would provoke Maryland and Kentucky to secede. He had no choice about that. But he became convinced in 1862 that there was no way to win the war without emancipation. And that
the military necessity argument?
Exactly.
So even then, this was about the Union, not about slavery, not about freedom.
Well, no. Okay. I mean, not precisely. I mean, when he made the argument, it was about the Union. He said to Horace Greeley that everything I do is for the Union. If it would save the Union to preserve slavery, I would do that. If it would save the Union to destroy slavery, I'd do that. If it would save the Union to free some slaves and...
Where's the high moral ground in all that?
Well, those are the positions he has to take.
Is but this his the tragic motive, pragmatism?
Yes, of course.
But pragmatism then toward what end, ultimately?
Once he's made that decision, the meaning of his own act begins to change. Mm. And if you look at the second inaugural address, one of the things he says about the second inaugural address is that I assumed that this was a war about preserving the Union mm-hmm. and about preserving the sanctity of the ballot. Mm-hmm. In other words, that he had seen the South as seceding because they could not abide by the result of an election that they had fairly lost. Mm-hmm. And of course, those are issues in the war, and they matter to Lincoln intensely.
Yes.
But he also says both sides knew somehow that slavery was the cause of the war. And the key word there is the somehow.
He literally said somehow.
Somehow.
That sounds so contemporary and kind of almost rhetorically sloppy, and yet he didn't.
Well, what somehow means is we knew it and didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
We knew it in our heart of hearts but didn't acknowledge it. And, of course, the person he's describing is himself there.
Yes, and this also describing this kind of ephemeral moving frontier of moral understanding in democracy.
You know, he says that the North understood the war as a war about union and the South understood the war as a war about independence, but both of them were wrong. Both of them were being driven by urgencies they really didn't understand about slavery. And that 2 years of violence had clarified his mind about it.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening in the second inaugural is that he's beginning to say, one of the reasons the war was so violent is that we didn't know what it was about and we wouldn't face what it was about and we're paying the price for that.
And here we are.
And also, as he's doing that, his own mind is changing about yet another issue in the course of the war. It's one thing to say it's a war about emancipation. It's another thing to say it's a war about racial equality. Now, Lincoln, every occasion he had, denied that he was interested in racial equality. And he probably was sincere when he did that.
Even when he was talking about emancipation. He was
even when
drawing
he was talking
this
about
distinction
emancipation.
As we saw in the Spielberg's movie.
But he was making promises that could not be fully realized unless racial equality was in the penumbra of his intentions.
The penumbra. That word comes back. And the penumbra matters because every step you take creates a new kind of radius of moral possibility.
You know, if you make citizens – if you make people into soldiers and mm-hmm. one of the chief reasons he emancipated the slaves was to recruit freed slaves into the U.S. Army.
Yes.
You give those soldiers an investment in the res publica. They are citizens in the way that civilians who are mm-hmm. about getting and spending and making money and raising mm-hmm. children mm-hmm. don't have an investment in the res publica.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly realized that that mounted a very strong pressure for racial equality.
Let me bring in Robin from Charleston, South Carolina, no mean address. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I want to thank Zach for saying half of what I wanted to say.
He's great.
And yeah. I wanted to kind of pipe in on that and say I think that the Foner book is The Fiery Trial.
Yes, that's the book.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that Foner argues is that Lincoln's morality included a dedication to this inestimable jewel, democracy.
Yes.
And so it was a kind of a long process for him to be able to actually take the power that he had to take as commander-in-chief, whether it was to totally defeat the slaves, the idea of total war, I mean totally defeat the South, total war, and to emancipate the slaves.
So, I totally agree with that. And I'm so glad to hear somebody from Charleston, South Carolina saying that. Excuse me. I didn't mean to stop you from speaking. Go on.
Hired history teacher, and as soon as I read the review of your book in the New York Times this weekend, I immediately forwarded it to one of my former students who's at Harvard right now, and he's actually beginning to deal with political philosophy. So he's really beginning to learn all of this stuff himself, and it's so exciting to have these conversations about Lincoln going on simultaneously with Obama. And I wondered, have you read James T. Koppenberg's book, Reading Obama, and do you see parallels?
Oh, he's a good friend of mine, and I do see parallels in their habit of mind, though I don't think that Obama is as brooding and dark a character as Lincoln is. And we're not going to kill each other over health care reform, but I think he certainly draws a lot of cues from Lincoln. Absolutely.
Cues. So, I mean, he's been very ready throughout his political life to take on the trappings, the references, the resonance of Lincoln. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think because he's a deep student of American history and culture.
But a deep student, but a light practitioner?
Oh, no. I don't mean this to be critical of Obama at all. But I don't think that we're about to fight civil war over the issues that – I mean, I think there are parallels.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to remember that we're not going to be coming to shooting over these issues.
Well, but some people do look around today, don't limit it to Obamacare, but they do see a kind of gridlock, a kind of interests trumping a moral view. However they see that, intransigence that some days seems to be grinding the wheels of our democracy to something like a halt, even a mortal threat sort of a halt, where we're just not taking care of business.
Sam Tannenhaus had a very smart article in the New Republic just this week, mm-hmm. where he argues that the contemporary right learned way too many things from John C. Calhoun. And among them was the dig in your heels, hold on at all costs mentality that they've adopted, and the belief that even the most limited surrender is a fatal sacrifice. Mm. One of the things that Obama has understood about politics, and it's a lesson Lincoln also knew, mm-hmm. is that if you expect to succeed, you don't ask for fatal sacrifices from your opponents. And he certainly has done his best to make his policy suggestions in such a way that they don't call for fatal sacrifices. But the difficulty with that position, and this is also the difficulty with Lincoln's position, is that it depends upon their willingness to see that the sacrifices they're called on to make aren't fatal ones.
Let me get one more call here. Our time is so short and there are so many, and I apologize for those I can't get. But Will in Leominster, Massachusetts. Will, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. You talked earlier about where governing on principle comes in versus just the consent of the public.
Yes.
And, you know, the general idea of the public. And all you need to look to is the Declaration and to see that slavery was incompatible with the founding principles of the country. And, you know, the Declaration is what explains the whole purpose of our government and of, you know, our country. And so all Lincoln or anyone has to do is just simply look to the Declaration for any justification on ending slavery.
Well, I get it. It sounds simple, but Lincoln himself didn't instantly have a fully realized vision of that end of slavery, as we're hearing. I appreciate your call, Will. I mean, take us to this point, John, this evolution of our understanding of what's required in our founding documents, essence.
Well, I think we have a pretty clear idea about issues that reasonable people aren't allowed to disagree about anymore. You know, it's not possible to say we should be enslaving people. It's not possible to say all sorts of bad things. Douglass's argument is that you can only say that if you know you've already won the war you're inviting. In other words, if you're dealing with an opponent whom you really are not in a position to have your way with, you have to deal. We had to deal with Stalin. It mm-hmm. wasn't right to deal with Stalin. It wasn't morally clean to deal with Stalin, but we couldn't defeat Stalin. We had to deal with him.
And Lincoln's view, once more, we've got just a minute, his alternate view to Douglass right there.
Well, Lincoln very reluctantly was forced into confrontation, but he learned, I think, not just from Douglass but from himself, that there's a great threat involved in taking yourself, taking up the sword of God in your own hands, because it's a great appeal to a kind of moral narcissism that Lincoln was repelled by. The idea that people are acting with doing God's will offended him in the second inaugural, because such people worship really a God who is themselves with a louder voice, mm-hmm. mustering all of the darkest aspects of their own personalities in their service. And one of the great things about Lincoln is his refusal to do that even when he opts for moral confrontation.
Though he must have felt the temptation.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, in the movie, there's the scene, you know, we heard a bit of it. I am the president cloaked in great powers, and he wants them to feel that power.
Well, the interesting thing is you can love your enemies and still kill them. And that is the hard, that is one of the hard arts about being a world leader, is that sometimes you do have to fight, but you have to manage that fight in such a way that you can imagine getting along later with the relatives of the people you killed.
How we missed Lincoln's memoirs, you know. If only, do we know what he thought, democracy.
Well,
did he trust it in the end, having had to go to war to...
I think he loved it above all things. But I think, I think that democracy is a very, very difficult thing to love. But it's also a very essential thing to love. If you don't love it, what happens to you?
John Burt's book is important. It is deep. It's terrific. It's Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism. Lincoln, Douglas, and Moral Conflict. This hour has flown. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. Listeners, thank you for joining us. Tenting Tonight, Pete Seeger right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Tenting on the old camp ground. Tenting tonight. Tenting tonight. Tenting on the old camp ground. Tenting tonight. Tenting tonight, tenting on the old campground.